ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
Good morning and welcome to The Constitution Matters here on 1180 WFYL, We the People. This morning we have joining us Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia, and also Phil Duffy, who is taught at Widener University, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, both joining us via the phone this morning. Gentlemen, again, welcome to the program, and our topic for this morning is the granddaddy of all when it comes to politics. The title of the Constitutional Corner article put out by Gary this week is "They're All Crooks?" Asking the question. And it starts like this. There is nothing new about corruption in government. It is a problem as old as government itself. And that's what we're going to be talking about this morning. Corruption in government. Gary, welcome to the program this morning. And Phil, again, welcome.
Thank you. Morning, Michael.
Good morning. Gary, well, corruption in government is almost a given, unfortunately. And it's something that, as a people of this great nation, we have become accustomed to. And the founders knew that that was something that they constantly had to protect against, and they put vehicles to do so in our Constitution.
Well, exactly. Right, and the chief Federalist paper that we have that speaks to this issue is Federalist 51, and in that, Madison makes it very clear that he would have preferred that the government design not require any checks and balances, as they're called, but it's just not practical. He says if men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls or government would be necessary. However, that's not the case. We have a government administered by men, over men, and so his next sentence says, in framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself. And as we know, just from human nature, that and the Federalists, the framers certainly shared this view that man is a fallen creature, is a sinful creature, and when he's given the ability to abuse power, he will in fact abuse power. So there has to be something in the design of government that it, if not eliminates, and I don't think it can be eliminated, but at least minimizes the potential effects of corruption.
And that's the big question. Can we find something that can actually accomplish that very task? Now, Phil Duffy, again, you're joining us as well this morning. Phil, what else can we do in our Constitution? What provides a vehicle that may be effective more so than normal measures in governments around the world?
Well, I think it begins with a reflection on what government really is. We use the term so often that it's become trite. Government is the accumulation of power. The term is an abstraction, but there is an aggregate reality behind it, people exercising power over other people. It's how that aggregate of people behave that we cover with that simple label, government. And as Washington observed, government is not reason, it's not eloquence, it is force. Like fire, it is a dangerous servant and a fearful master. Never for a moment should it be left to irresponsible action. And Lord Acton probably has given us the most famous quote on the accumulation of power. Power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. Great men are almost always bad men. So on earlier shows, we discussed the relationship of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution with the natural law, and we can think of the natural law as a reflection of the good side of human nature, the good that we are naturally drawn to. The founding fathers were also very sensitive to the darker side of human nature, the tendency toward corruption. They knew, like Lord Acton, who came after them, that the tendency toward corruption increases as power is accumulated. Their political challenge, as they saw it, was to first limit the accumulation of power in government, but when that accumulation was deemed necessary, to manage it optimally. And that was the genius of the founding generation. And the best description of their attempt to balance these two sides of human nature appears in The Federalist, as Gary has mentioned. That was a series of essays written by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay to convince the people to support the proposed Constitution. And Gary Wills has an excellent introduction and commentary on The Federalist, which identifies the five themes that underlie the Constitution. And they are federalism, checks and balances, separation of powers, pluralism, and representation. And when we consider these themes, it becomes apparent that the entire purpose of the Constitution is to limit the accumulation of power. And to the extent that power must be accumulated in government, to assure that that power is separated among the branches of government, and finally to have each branch check the tendency towards corruption in the others. And you see it in the division of the Federalists into two major sections. The first 36 are about the Articles of Confederation and how they're inadequate. And the remaining are about a Republican solution to the Union's needs, a Constitution. So it is in the second section of essays that Hamilton, Madison, and Jay identify how this constitutional republic will minimize corruption of various types. And although the number 51, as Gary has mentioned, is important, if you look at that entire section, it really deals with that issue of managing corruption.
Now, Phil, just to interject to our listeners, you can call, and if you have a question for Gary or Phil, that's 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255, or toll-free at 1-877-667-1180. So let's then pose one other point to the conversation as far as corruption. You know, Gary, you cite in your article, and you make a citation of actually Wikipedia as far as how it defines corruption, but there's something in that which you wanted to point out. Wikipedia isn't necessarily a source that's used, but it's not necessarily the guts of the information you're interested in. You're more interested in how they kind of divvy up corruption and what that says about how much it's developed in our society.
Right. I was surprised to find that Wikipedia had put such a fine touch on corruption that there were different categories and a lot of categories. And I remarked that when you get this many categories of corruption, then you certainly have a problem. When it becomes so pervasive that you can categorize it and define it with precision, it has become a much bigger problem than it probably should be. But the founders, the framers knew that this was a problem. They understood human nature in a biblical sense, and they did give us some remedies in the Constitution itself to deal with corruption when it inevitably, as they would say, occurs. Certainly one of those is impeachment, and we can talk about that in some detail. That has been used to a constitutional remedy. It's as much a constitutional remedy as the basic design of three branches of government.
Then the other remedy is expulsion of a member, and since the Constitution gave each House of the Congress the ability to set its own rules, therefore both houses have done so and have defined what constitutes grounds for expulsion. And then they have, in fact, gone ahead and expelled members from both the Senate and the House over the years. So there's those two remedies, and we can get into more detail on that if you'd like, but at least know that the framers understood what could happen and gave us these remedies.
Now, I would like to know personally these rules, because you cite in your article, this is Article 1, Section 5 of the Constitution, you cite that, it says, each House of Congress may determine the rules of its proceedings, punish its members for disorderly behavior, and with the concurrence of two-thirds, expel a member. And that's where we get impeachment from. But I would like to know more about determining the rules of its proceedings. And you said that almost as if each House in Congress can determine its own set of rules, which we would suppose all members of Congress are bound by. I would love to know what those are, how can they change, and how bound are they to those rules?
Well, I have not researched the actual rules themselves, but since they have to be a public document, I'm certain that if you go out to the House Ethics Committee or the Senate Ethics Committee's website, you will find a downloadable document that contains the current rules of each House. So they're there, and I'm certain that all the members, as they come into elective office, are given an extensive briefing, and maybe even annual briefings on what are the rules that we expect you to adhere to, and how are we going to proceed if we feel that you have violated those rules. Now, a lot of members get into trouble with campaign finance, and so you have to look at the convoluted nature of some of our campaign finance laws and say, yeah, who could even adhere to these? They are so complex and convoluted. So some of it is built in the complexity of the rules that they have to adhere to, but nevertheless, I think the rules have to be pretty clearly stated, and every member, I'm certain, is given at least an initial opportunity to learn them and learn what will be expected of his behavior.
Well, could I make a comment about the expulsion of legislative members? It seems to me that there are really two ways that you get rid of a bad congressman. One is expulsion, which is that internal process of each house that can be applied. But also, the way the system is set up is that the people themselves can vote the rascals out. Impeachment, on the other hand, seems to apply to the legislative, to the executive branch and to the judicial branch.
Now that's an interesting thought.
Well, yeah, if I could comment on that, that is correct. And in fact, the House impeached a senator at one time, and the Senate, when they conducted the trial, refused to convict him because they thought that impeachment was the wrong remedy for this. The Senate had already expelled Senator Blount, so it was kind of a fait accompli, but nevertheless, they conceded that impeachment was not the correct remedy for a member of either House of the Congress, that the expulsion remedy was correct.
Now, what is the process for a judge? Because in our society, especially right now, the Supreme Court hearing arguments on homosexual marriage, I believe they're supposed to actually rule, is it today, but then we're not going to know about that for some time after when they release that. But what is the process for a judge to be impeached for our listeners?
Well, go ahead, Phil.
Okay. The process is basically standard, with the exception of the President of the United States, where the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court presides in an impeachment trial. But basically, impeachment is impeachment. It's a standard process. The impeachment itself is like an indictment of a supreme, of a grand jury. It determines whether charges are necessary, and it must originate in the House of Representatives. And the impeachment trial itself must be conducted in the Senate, and you must have two-thirds of the senators agree on the guilt of the impeachment.
And then I'm sure it has to be something on ethical grounds in which the impeachment is brought, even though
right.
where some people may simply would like to attempt to remove a judge or even another congressional official from office simply because of maybe past votes or stances on issues, that's not going to be possible underneath the Constitution.
Those listening, my age will remember probably an attempt back in the 60s, that's the 1960s, to impeach Earl Warren, Chief Justice Earl Warren. All throughout the South, there were billboards and signs saying impeach Earl Warren, and you can go out and on Google, you can find, in fact, examples of these. Well, it wasn't a successful effort, because there's an unwritten rule. We talk about our unwritten Constitution. There's a lot of features that just weren't written down, but which have come to be standard ways we operate over the years. But there's an unwritten feature in our Constitution that it says a judge will not be impeached for his opinions, his or her opinions. That it must be some behavioral maladministration or misbehavior. And when you look at the history of judicial proceedings against, or impeachment proceedings against judges, that's exactly the way it has been carried out. Judges have been impeached. They have been, in fact, removed from the bench. One Associate Justice of the Supreme Court was even impeached, although not convicted. And they have all been for misbehavior, showing up drunk in court and being rude and disrespectful to witnesses in court, and just being an obnoxious person on the bench. So that's the standard, is misbehavior, not for opinion. So when we look at the way the Supreme Court is going to judge on this homosexual marriage issue, as much as we would like to remove some judges, perhaps, for their opinion, or let's just take the conduct of Justices Ginsburg and Kagan, who charges are that they should recuse themselves because of their prejudicial opinions about this issue. Even that will not, I'm certain, rise to the level of impeachment.
Now, it's interesting to think as well that those who look at the Constitution as a living document, one that can constantly change, when you take that principle and apply it where it works best for you, it's a wonderful thing. But if that was applied to, say, impeachment for a federal judge, where, well, it does say this, that it's based and you cannot make it based on a judge's opinion. Now, it is a little different for a judge because their rulings are opinion when you get down to it, because the judge is the final authority. It has to be opinion. They're supposed to be able to vet out the gray areas in our law. But it's interesting, those who argue that the Constitution is a living document, how if you want to venture into this area, if it doesn't work for one's particular argument, you'll find a lot of resistance. Phil?
Well, yeah. Go ahead, Phil.
Yeah, I think part of the problem here is when you look at the difference between Article 2, which covers the responsibilities of the executive, and Article 3, the judiciary. The third article of the Constitution almost seems to be an afterthought in terms of how much effort went into that. And there is only one reference in terms of the duties or responsibilities of the member of the judiciary, which is this idea of good behavior, which nowhere is defined. And so, you know, you have to fall back on this idea of what is good behavior. Well, if somebody shows up drunk in court, then obviously there's a problem there. But how often is that going to be a problem? The real problem is somebody who obviously is ruling with their opinions counter to the intent of the Constitution. However, if you rule that out and say, well, that's acceptable behavior, then there really is no check on the judicial side. Now, on the executive side, you can look through a broader definition of responsibilities, and you can say the president hasn't done this, failed to do this, you know, obvious things. But even so, if you look at the history of impeachment, we've attempted to impeach a president twice, and in the trials, those trials have been unsuccessful in both cases. So impeachment really has very limited value below the top level of both the judicial and the executive branch.
And then sometimes it's just, my opinion differs from yours, and you just have a battle of opinions. If you have a question about the Constitution for Gary Porter or for Phil Duffy, please call our number. That's 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255. Be happy to take your call, or toll free at 1-877-667-1180. Well, let's continue in our main topic on corruption. You know, there was a interesting thing that you cited in your article on this, Gary. A pastor's briefing by Wall Builders as far as corruption in our government. Can you tell us about that?
Well, yes, to kind of put a capstone on the corruption thing. You know, we've heard the phrase, everyone in Washington is corrupt. They're all a bunch of thieves out to make themselves rich at our expense with public money. And, you know, it's an often used phrase, sometimes out of exasperation. But you've heard it. I've heard other people say it. I may have even said it myself in the past. But that past week, visit to the Wall Builders Pastors Conference convinced me that is an unfair accusation. It is just totally unfair to lump everybody into this, as I called it, incorrigible pot. As much as we'd like to frame D.C. in that kind of broad brush, it is certainly unfair. Because this pastor's briefing brings you face-to-face with the reality that there are people in Congress who do have a strong Christian faith, who live by their principles, who vote by their principles, and we got a chance to meet them that last week, so at least some of them. So when we come back from our break, I hope we can go into that in more detail. But I do want to add one little capstone to this impeachment issue, if we can. There was a federal district judge, Alcee Hastings in Florida, who was impeached for taking a bribe, and he was convicted and removed from the bench. And then he ran for office, and the good people of Florida sent him back to Congress.
Wonderful. Good to hear. Well, this is We the People, the Constitution Matters. Remember, it's we the people that matter, and you can find all of that written and etched in the very heart of our nation, and that's in our Constitution. That's what we're talking about in our topic this morning, corruption in government. We'll be back from our break. Go ahead, call in 610-539-TALK, 610-539-8255, or toll free 1-877-667-1180.
Working for your liberty right here in Philadelphia, broadcasting freedom shining light throughout the tri-state area, streaming freedom shining light from Philly to the 1180 shining forth, we are the Freedom Station, WFY.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.
The Apostle Paul wrote in Ephesians 6:10 to be strong in the Lord and in the power of His might so we can stand in the evil day. Let me ask you, are you standing strong in the Lord and in the power of His might? Hello, I'm Sam Rohr, president of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network and the American Pastors Network, agreeing with the Apostle Paul that when the days are evil, we need God's armor. To modern culture, right is wrong and wrong is right. Good is evil and evil is good. The war against God, the truth, and God's people was started by the devil and is in full swing. The Bible tells us that all who will live godly in Christ Jesus will be targeted and will suffer persecution in the spiritual war. So what must we do? Put on the whole armor of God. Imagine, God designed armor to help us in the spiritual battle and available to us. In the next few weeks, we'll look at this armor of God and what it's for and why we'd better put it on. I'm Sam Rohr, president of the American Pastors Network, asking you, did you put on God's armor today? Are you even in the battle?
Sign up as a partner at papastors.net.
Hey, Grandma, can you help me with my Common Core lesson on the Constitution? But the only part we're reading in 8th grade is the preamble and the First Amendment. I wonder when we'll get to study the rest of it. Didn't you say our founding fathers were wise patriots and wrote the Constitution and the Bill of Rights to protect our freedom? This Common Core book we're reading says our founding fathers were racist and they didn't think women or blacks should ever be allowed to vote. She says, we the people, didn't really mean you and me, but some rich white guys. That just makes me feel terrible about our country. We need to change things.
Oh, honey, that's not true at all. Our country is the greatest country the world has ever seen, and our founding fathers worked hard to be fair to everyone. I'm going to call our school board and our state board of education and ask why they allow Common Core and this book in your school.
Call your representatives now and ask them to stop Common Core and restore local control. Pennsylvanians Against Common Core brought you this message. Go to nopacommoncore.com or call 484-678-2236.
All right. I know this isn't any fun to talk about, but we should. So, who's going to do what? Flashlights?
Nowhere to be found.
Where to be found? Batteries?
Dead.
Great. Emergency supply kits?
Not packed.
No. What about blankets?
We have an old towel.
Good enough. Cell phones?
May not work.
Emergency water?
Not a drop.
And what about food?
Nope.
Perfect. We all know where we're meeting if we're separated, yeah?
The library!
Aunt Joan's house.
The bus stop.
Great. And I'll be waiting here wondering where you all are. It sounds like we don't have a plan. Who's up for mini golf?
Winging it is not an emergency plan. Make sure your kids know what to do during an emergency. Who to call, where to meet, what to pack. Visit ready.gov/kids for tips and information. A public service announcement brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
Good morning and welcome to We the People, the Constitution Matters on 1180 WFYL. You can call in with any question you have about the Constitution. We have Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative in Yorktown, Virginia, on the phone with us. Also is Phil Duffy, teaches at Widener University, Osher Lifelong Learning Institute on the Constitution. So if you have a question for either of them, again, call 610-539 TALK, 610-539-8255, or toll-free at 1-877-667-1180. I'm Mike Levins, and we're talking about this topic this morning, corruption in government. And what we were just discussing before we hit the break, and Gary, this is what you wanted to delve into a little bit more, was actually a pastor's briefing given by Wall Builders. Now, Wall Builders is headed up by David Barton, who is actually sometimes even a figure of controversy himself. In a lot of ways, he's been improperly portrayed in the media. But there was a conference put on by his organization, or a briefing, rather, for pastors about different members of Congress who are working in a rather positively way. We're going to delve into that a little bit more as a way to kind of balance the scales here when talking about corruption in government. Gary?
Yes, well, Wall Builders organization has been around for quite some time. I don't know exactly the date, the year it was founded, but we're talking at least 20 or 30 years that David Barton has been building this thing. And the name comes from the Old Testament book of Nehemiah, and is actually a response to Psalm 11:3, which says, "If the foundations be destroyed, what shall the righteous do?" Well, if the foundations be destroyed, then we need to build them back up, and that's the goal of Wall Builders. So part of their ministry is what they call pastors' briefings, and twice a year they gather in Washington, D.C. with their team, and they conduct these events for pastors or others who are involved in Christian ministry in some way. And I was fortunate enough to attend with my wife last week, and it really put an entirely different complexion on Congress. I knew that I had met with my congressman on several occasions, and I knew he was a Christian, and from the way he talked and discussed things. But I had no idea that there were so many Christians in Congress. There's a recent poll that has concluded that 92% of congressmen identify themselves as Christian. I think that's probably as high as it may have been since the colonial period, when close to 100% of the Congress would have identified themselves as Christian. And it's a much higher figure that I think than most people realize. And some of these Christians are, in fact, really deeply committed, evangelical Christians who believe that their faith should, in fact, inform the way they operate, the way they vote, the way they discuss issues, etc. So it's a very heartening experience to go through this. It is by invitation only, and because of the rooms that they use in the congressional district, they're limited to, in terms of numbers who can attend. It's basically 120 is their max number. But even then, that's a reasonably large group. And the event begins the first night with a tour of the Capitol. Now, tours of the Capitol are given every day through the Capitol Visitor Center. And you can, as a private citizen, you can go in there and become part of those tours, and you'll hear a nice presentation on some of the history of the Capitol building. But what's nice about the Wall Builders tour is that it's conducted in the evening when the Capitol is otherwise vacant, and you may encounter only one other private tour during that whole time. So you basically have the building to yourself, and you will hear some history from David Barton and his son Tim that you will not hear on the public tours, because they either don't think it's important or purposely omit some of the Christian references that the building has just hanging from its walls and embedded in its statuary.
And David Barton, of course, has one of the largest, if not the largest, in this country of colonial-era publications by many of our founding fathers, and those who were very close to the Founding Fathers and had much to do with the Revolution. So he has his own, again, and those are original documents. He has one of the largest libraries of originals, if not the largest, in the nation. And that is where he derives much of his information from. It's right from the source. But let's...
Oh, yes.
let's go ahead. There's something interesting you said. You said 92% of congressmen believe or state that they are Christian. And I have to say, there's got to be something wrong with that. And this is the sermon that everyone who attends church has heard, that how many people in this nation say they're Christian, yet look at all the things that are happening and look at all of the different circumstances and things that people support. Because I do know that 92% of our congressmen most certainly do not stand against something that you would think is very scripturally clear. Like homosexual marriage. I know that 92% of our congressmen do not stand against that. And while they're, you know, so I find a little bit of a disconnect there, because that's not the only issue, I'm sure. Abortion being another issue, especially for Christians, those really being the two hot buttons for Christians, homosexuality and abortion. That number, I find, can probably have some inaccuracy in there.
Well, it's a self-reported number, so it is
sure.
It's based on what the member identifies themselves as, and but you and I both know that there are Christians, and then there are Christians. There are Christians who go to church once a year at Easter and feel very content in identifying themselves as Christians, and then there are Christians who tear the door down as many times as they can to get in there and have fellowship and learn the Bible and practice their faith. So you have the whole dichotomy and the whole range of Christian faith involved in this, I'm sure. But it also was pointed out by David that of 60 new freshman congressmen that came in on the last election, the 2014 election, a good 40 of those were not just Christians, but evangelical committed Christians. And David takes pains to make sure that those congressmen, senators, and representatives who come over and talk to us during the pastor's briefing are ones whose voting record reflects their Christian faith. And so you're quite correct in saying that there's some suspicion in this 92% number, because the voting records of all these 92% are 491 is the exact number. 491 out of the 535 members identify themselves as Christian, but when you look at the voting record, you have reason to doubt whether their Christian faith really informs their day-to-day activities as a congressman.
And speaking to the Christians, there is, of course, what Jesus said. There will be many who come, Lord, Lord, didn't we do this in your name and prophesy in your name and cast out demons? And he'll say, away from me, I never knew you. That scripture is one that is taught widely in Christian circles to protect against that very thing. Those who may think, well, yeah, I go to church on Easter, you know, once a year and I'm good. They think they just have to go ahead and show up once a year, and then God's all good with them, and then Christ is nowhere evident in their life at all. There's no relationship there. That's a false premise. Well, Phil, I want to go to you now as far as talking about there is still hope, and there are most certainly men and women in Congress who are Christian and who are committed to doing what's right and who are holding themselves accountable to the Constitution and what it stands for. Now, Gary, one of the things you cite in your article is prayer, and that is what is emphasized by this pastor's intensive, I guess I could call it, or a briefing, that prayer is really the main catalyst, at least for the Christian, that is going to bring about these changes. And I'm sure that was even communicated by the congressman. But Phil, going on that tangent, though, for prayer, what really is going to be... So we pray and we go before God, but is that really going to be the be-all, end-all? Your thoughts?
Well, that's a very interesting question to pose to me, because in a past show I was asked to contribute the so-called secular point of view. And so in commenting on this, I think that my reputation may be put in danger. But nonetheless, I am a person of faith, by the way. But I think there's also there's room to present the secular point of view. Any way you look at it, whether it's secular or non-secular, you have to come back to a set of principles. And those principles must guide you. That's what the system of law is all about. It's all about establishing a set of principles. And the question then becomes one of, well, where do those principles come from? And we talked earlier in this show about the natural law, that inclination toward doing good for each other, which is a part of our freedoms. Yes, we are free, but we're free as long as we don't aggress against others. So I would agree that, yes, ultimately, even if you come from a secular perspective, you must fall back on principle, ultimately. And for the Christian has to have that conversation with God in order to determine what those principles are.
Gary, your thoughts?
Well, absolutely, and the founders would agree that your religious views are absolutely indispensable. George Washington, in his farewell address after two terms as our president, said, "Of all the dispositions and habits which lead to political prosperity, religion and morality are indispensable supports." Now, indispensable is an important word. It is exactly what it says. These are indispensable supports to good government, to political prosperity. And in vain would that man, he goes on, in vain would that man claim the tribute of patriotism who should labor to subvert these great pillars of human happiness. So the founders would have agreed with us today that when we say that religious faith is extremely important, in fact, critical to good government, and that a representative, a congressman or a senator who says he can do his job without reverting to his faith or without having any faith at all to revert to, that's a very dangerous precedent. Our founders would certainly not have subscribed to that.
We all have to believe in something. Even the atheist who says that they believe in nothing believes that they believe in nothing. So we all have to believe in something. And religion, specifically Christianity, specifically Christ, is not just a strong or critical pillar. It's the only pillar. And the thing that comes to mind is, as Christians, that we are to forsake all other things and follow Christ, and he is to be prevalent in our lives, and there's no divisions there. That's in our lives as a whole, and no part is separate. Even the political sphere, all of that is submitted to Christ as Christians, and that is the only hope to turn around our nation. It is in Jesus Christ.
Absolutely.
And as we, Phil, I'd like to, as we're, we still have some time, but I would love, though, to delve a little bit more into this corruption idea in Congress. And we know it's there. People are corrupt all over the world for many different things. And one of the things, again, that is the biggest concern of citizens is the national debt. And that has been supported by this corruption, whether it's earmarks, whether it is personal projects, different deals for lobbyists. We know that part of, if not the majority of, that debt has to do and is from the corruption we are seeing in Congress at times.
Well, Mike, if you had the ability to analyze that debt in terms of is it constitutional or is it non-constitutional, very difficult exercise, of course, But nonetheless, my suspicion is that about 90% of that comes from extra constitutional activity. And if you define extra constitutional activity as corruption, it is corruption in a sense, then you realize the magnitude of what's going on. Here's something that is overwhelming in terms of its implications for the individual voter. This is a redistribution of income that is occurring on a massive basis, and an accumulation of power is behind that. Ultimately, what is happening is that our representatives are looking the other way in terms of the Constitution and saying, okay, I have this thought that I got up with this morning that this would be a good idea, and that drives them. And so they vote for this or they vote for that. Well, ultimately, why are they voting for these things? They're voting for them because their office has been overrun with lobbyists. And the lobbyists really come in with two messages. Here's what we think you should do. But the second message never is stated, doesn't have to be. It's that subtle one that if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. And ultimately, it comes down to the fact that these opportunities to get around the Constitution really result in campaign contributions down the road. And this is the way a congressman keeps his or her job. They have to go out and appeal to the voters, and that's a very expensive process. But if you look at it in this manner, if there were no opportunities to violate the Constitution, there would be no lobbyists. And if there were no lobbyists, we would not have the debt that we have today.
And that's an interesting point you make there, that lobbyists are the source of many of our corruption woes. Because if you think about how that works, the lobbyist comes in, and like you said, the unspoken factor, if you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. There was an expose done some years ago, which we talked a little bit about off the air before the show, called Insiders. It was done by 60 Minutes, and it noted that under law, until about 2 years ago, it was legal for congressmen to participate and other government officials in insider trading in the stock market, and it be actually legal. Now, the Stock Act was passed in 2013, which made that illegal. But since that point, a major part of that act was that transactions done by congressmen and government officials would be available for public review via an electronic database. That part of the bill has since been, very quietly, might I add, gutted. Because, again, listen to these numbers. In the House, it was passed by a voice-only vote, so no votes were recorded. It took 10 seconds to pass the House in a unanimous, what was reported as unanimous vote. Senate took 14 seconds to pass. And again, these were the amendments to the Stock Act, which eliminated the disclosure of transactions of members of Congress via an electronic database, which was searchable, because now with that gone, the only way to find out what congressmen are doing with their finances in the stock market, as if they're abiding by this law that now outlaws insider trading among them, the only way to access that is to physically go to the government office in D.C. and search a database that's PDF documents, so you can't even search by keyword. You have to look through each individual document, and it's 10 cents a page to print them out if you would want. So,
well, the good news is there are people who will do that.
That is the good news.
Yes. There are organizations who are devoted to watching over Judicial Watch, and there are several others that are devoted to watching Congress and watching carefully what goes on. So I'm certain that even as hard as it may be for private citizens to see this transparency, there are organizations that are going to make sure that somebody is looking.
And the most alarming thing out of that, again, to kind of cap our talk on corruption, is the gutting that took place so quietly and so quickly, with no debate, no room for public discourse, because the act that actually outlawed insider trading came from this expose that was done 2 years earlier on the fact that insider trading in Congress was legal, and that statistically congressmen, for some reason, do really well in the stock market. And I really wonder why, because they influence legislation. And if insider trading is not legal, in fact, the one reporter had to ask Nancy Pelosi in a news conference. She had gotten a very generous IPO, or participated in an IPO, initial public offering, from Visa at a time when there was key legislation that was being debated on the Hill. And she was, of course, in Congress at that time. It's very hard to reconcile those things. It's very, very hard, Gary.
Well, it is, but people need to become engaged in this. If this is a concern, and I think it should be, then they need to be engaging with their representatives. They need to be expressing their view in personal visits, in emails, in letters, etc. If people sit back and wring their hands and say, oh, there's nothing we can do, this is just Washington, then it's going to continue. But people need to engage, and as they do on every single issue. During the Wall Builders tour, we got a chance to see the prayer chapel in Congress, or in the Capitol building, and we were assured that that chapel gets used frequently. Now, obviously, a congressman doesn't have to leave his office and go down to the prayer chapel in order to pray for guidance as to a particular vote. And I know they don't. They drop to their knees wherever they are in their offices, and they do pray for guidance. And we heard this straight from the horse's mouth, if you will, from many representatives and senators during the pastor's conference. So I'm quite convinced that there are people of faith who are looking to God for their guidance, who are committed to making sure that their votes and their performance of duty reflects their Christian values. So I came away from this conference with a much more confident feeling that I had that our Congress is in pretty good hands. Now, that doesn't mean that there can't be room for improvement, and there certainly needs to be everyone's attention focused on electing people to office who have a strong faith and are willing to stand on that faith, talk about that faith, and show that they will use that faith as they vote.
Phil, I would love you to have the last word. We've got about 45 left in the program.
Well, it sounds like we've got the music coming in there, so perhaps rather than launch into an idea here, maybe we ought to just leave it at that.
Well, that will be the last word then for today. Thank you for listening to We the People, The Constitution Matters here on 1180 WFYL. It's working for your liberty. That's right. We are doing that day in and day out. You have a wonderful day. We'll see you next week. Thank you for listening. From Gary Porter, Phil Duffy, and Mike Levins.
Hi, I'm Hans Tenbaum with Valley Forge PC Repair. I offer affordable and expert computer repair services. Deal with a locally owned business who cares more about their clients' needs. The services provided include virus removal, repair, cleanups, tune-ups, tutoring, consulting, and other computer services. Most services can be done at a flat rate. Senior citizens mentioned WFIL receive a 10% discount. Call me at 610-462-3210 for more information.
ShopRite of Hatfield is American-owned, locally operated grocer. We support veterans and seniors by giving 5% discounts. Just bring in your ID. Download the ShopRite mobile app to enjoy weekly savings, coupons, recipes, and so much more. ShopRite of Hatfield, 170 40-foot road, open 7 days a week, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m.
ShopRite, we're all about food, savings, and you.